Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Music Business Podcast presented by Hypebot.com. I'm your host, Kyle Balin. Today on the show, we are talking with Casey Ray, who is the CEO of the Future of Music Coalition, a nonprofit research, education, and advocacy organization for musicians. We are going to talk to Ray about the need for transparency in the music business. Make sure that you subscribe to Music Business Podcast in iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow the show and get the latest episodes on SoundCloud. And if you like the show, I'd love for you to rate us highly and submit a review in iTunes. Here is Courtney Harding's interview with Casey Ray.
For some of our listeners who aren't familiar with Future of Music Coalition, what are the organization's objectives and how have those objectives evolved since you started working there?
Well, our organization started in 2000, which in sort of the history of the music industry and technology seems like eons ago. We were formed basically at the time when, right at the verge of what was our founders understood was going to be a very, very big shakeup because of the advent of digital technology. And of course, that turned out to be perfectly true. Our organization was founded by largely musicians in the independent sector, independent labels, folks with an eye on technology, with a sense of where these possibilities might take us, and and composers. So it's kind of a ragtag group of folks, largely from the independent sector based in D.C. The thing that really motivated us and continues to kind of keep us pushing forward is that in Washington, there are a lot of decisions that are made at the federal policy level that end up impacting musicians as a whole without a lot of input from musicians themselves. So, you know, we're not a lobby shop. We're a 501c3 nonprofit. So it's not like we go up to, you know, Congress every day like the milkman. But what we try to do is introduce musicians' perspectives into the policy conversation through quantitative and qualitative research by, you know, actually talking to musicians. And the other part of what we do is we try to find a balance between the benefits of technology, which on one level is like a level playing field or a more level playing field where access to audiences isn't quite the, you know, nightmare scape of pain and confusion that it might have been, you know, 25 years ago. But on the other side of it, increasingly, it's a conversation about compensation. And one of the things that we're paying a lot of attention to right now is how to construct systems, both legal systems and sort of marketplace practices, that return some of the value that is generated from music back to the creator under fair terms. It's easier said than done because, you know, most of the laws and policies that govern what is or isn't possible in the marketplace and who is rewarded by activity in the marketplace were, you know, designed in a pre-internet era. But, you know, the fact that the job isn't done doesn't mean that, you know, that it's going to be done properly without the input of actual musicians.
So you wrote an op-ed in Billboard a couple months ago stating that major music publishers are now lobbying the federal government to be allowed to directly license their digital rights to music services rather than as part of a performing rights organization like ASCAP or BMI. Mm-hmm. Why is the ability to directly license their digital rights so important?
Well, the interesting thing is, again, if you want to talk about antiquated systems that nobody in their right mind ever would have invented if we had, you know, started from the ground floor with this, you know, thing called the internet, songwriters and music publishers exist under what's called a consent decree, at least for the public performance of musical works. And a public performance would be music that is broadcast on any type of radio, whether it's over-the-air radio or internet radio or satellite radio, as well as music that is played in live venues like concert halls, clubs, bars, restaurants, hotels, and so forth. So the reason that these consent decrees exist, and that is really just a fancy legal term of art for an agreement that the parties enter into where they agree to sort of curb certain behavior and accept certain conditions while not admitting, you know, guilt about anti-competitive behavior. So basically back in the 1940s, the only way to the marketplace really or was through performance of musical works. It was the only copyright that existed. The sound recording copyright didn't come around until 1972. So basically all you had was notes on paper and lyrics. And so the public performance of those works was, the licensing of those works for public performance was managed by the performing rights organization ASCAP. And what happened was ASCAP, you know, seemed to be, with the complicitness of the major publishers back then, or the publishers in general, kind of like acting as a gatekeeper to the world's repertoire. And if that had continued the way it was going, it probably would have meant that radio wouldn't have been able to get off the ground. And so the Department of Justice was going to bring like a lawsuit against against the PRO, ASCAP, and by proxy, the music publishers. But instead, they all accepted, you know, these consent decrees, which to some extent limits the opportunity for them to abuse their leverage in the marketplace. But it's not just about, you know, the publishers versus, say, radio. The coolest thing about the consent decrees is that it actually provided for songwriters to be able to become members of a PRO and get paid 50% of the royalty that was generated directly to them without any of that money being held by the publisher because of their debt to the publisher for advances or whatever. So it was a, you know, it was a very fair system. Later on, BMI entered into their own version of this consent decree in the 60s. Now, that worked more or less, or at least people didn't really complain about it for a number of decades. You know, there are some questions about the formula that ASCAP used or BMI used to determine, you know, the number of plays on radio or what songs are being performed in venues. But in general, songwriters, you know, accepted this quote-unquote mailbox money because in addition to the mechanical royalty that they got every single time a reproduction of the underlying musical work was made, they also received compensation for performances. So if you had a big hit on the radio, you know, ASCAP would send you money and you would go to your mailbox and get it. Nowadays in the digital marketplace, we're facing like an enormous shift to a new mode of experiencing music. It's going from a transaction-based environment to more of a plays or access-based environment. So the publishers feel that the consent decrees are limiting their ability to get the price that they want in the marketplace, particularly for the digital portion of their rights. The fastest growing portion of the marketplace for radio-like services is digital. So that's, you know, the universe of Pandora and other webcasters. Now, the publishers believe, possibly rightly, that if they leave ASCAP and BMI, they will be able to license directly with the services and get more money. That could possibly be true, but there's also other factors at play, which I can get to in a second. The real issue is that by leaving the PROs would kind of be weakened, because if the biggest publishers pull out their digital rights, the PROs are kind of, you know, losing the most meaningful part of that bundle, that copyright bundle. And the artists and, excuse me, the songwriters that remain with the PROs, you know, and don't have the advantage of necessarily being with Sony ATV, Universal Music Publishing Group, or Warner Chappell Music, might find themselves at a comparative disadvantage in terms of their own leverage. Because those guys are not, or independent publishers, for example, aren't going to be able to call up Pandora and get a meeting to negotiate. So it's basically tilts the playing field very, very quickly to just three major music publishers. The other issue is if you look over at the label side and the way the labels license to services, they for interactive services like Spotify, like on-demand services, those are direct negotiations. There is no consent decree. There is no statutory or compulsory environment where the government plays any role in rate setting or mediating rate setting disputes. It's like they negotiate, they come to terms or not, and that's kind of the way it goes. Well, frankly, you couldn't start an on-demand music service in 2015 unless you had about, you know, $4 million to hire the lawyers to get to the negotiation table. And then it would take you probably on average 2 years to get to the point where, you know, you had inked the deals necessary to get all that catalog. And at that time, the labels may have already managed to get other things from you right up front, which, you know, take the form of large cash advances, equity in the service, and so on and so forth, equity ownership. And the question on the label side is, does any of that money ever make it back to artists? And of course, another question is, are they horse trading all of these cash advances and other deal sweeteners for lower per stream rates? You see what I mean? So mm-hmm. I think the publishers kind of want what they're, you know, they see what the labels are able to do and they want that. But what we ask is like, we want songwriter compensation to go up. I'm just going to say this unequivocally, you know, we want it to go up across the board. What we're questioning is the mechanism for that, you know, increase in compensation. And to Future Music Coalition and our friends in the songwriter and independent publisher community, it really feels like, you know, this would really potentially weaken the ability for third-party organizations that collect and distribute royalties on the behalf of songwriters to get our share of the money to us directly, and also to make sure that, you know, we have representation on the governance board and that, you know, the deal terms are understandable and transparent. And so, you know, I'll stop talking now because you were going to ask me about transparency, and that's probably, you know, maybe the next kind of thing we can talk about.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting as you've been speaking because, I mean, you know, I feel like the ends they want are maybe not the worst, right? Like, they want artists, they want songwriters to get paid more. That's a laudable goal. But the problem is...
If that's their goal.
I'm
not really sure that that's their goal because, you know, again, the three major music publishers, which are owned by multinational corporations, Vivendi, Sony Electronics Corporation, and a Russian oil oligarch, you know, the bosses of these major publishers are probably just trying to not be divested or fired. One of the things that they do that frustrates transparency is, like, even in the global royalty collection and distribution environment, they have ways of, like, not being very clear about which artists get paid for reciprocal rights and so on and so forth. And if they can't find who to pay, or if they don't want to find who to pay, that money sits in escrow for like 5 years, and you know, after which it gets divided up by market share. My guess is that's probably a way to pad their valuation so they don't get sold by Sony Electronics Japan, you know? So I really do, at a fundamental level, sometimes question whether songwriter compensation is really their goal. If it is, I support an increase in songwriter compensation, just like most songwriters would, but not at the expense of, you know, some very, very hard-won guarantees like direct and equitable payment under fair splits and transparency in deal terms that are entered into on our behalf.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask just what the progress has been on this, and then we can talk about transparency. So since you wrote the op-ed in March, has anything moved forward? Is this just sort of still in discussions? Like, what's the latest?
Well, I certainly wouldn't claim credit for any of the sort of outcomes around this, but it was really interesting to see a lot of our songwriter friends on the international and you know, domestic stage kind of come together to ask some questions of the publishers themselves. Many of them were the same questions, like, you know, look, maybe those direct deal terms are awesome. Maybe they are, like, really favorable to the songwriters, but the songwriters need to know. They need to know what those terms are for deals that are made on their behalf. Another question is whether the publishers actually have all of the rights that they assert. Like, can they just pull their digital catalog very cleanly like that? Because, you know, in the label performer world, it's usually like one record label, one artist, or band. In the music publishing world, oh man, it gets really, really complex really, really quickly. I looked at a song by Flo Rida the other day. It had like 13 publishers at co-publishers and like 17 songwriters. And not all of these folks are based in the same territory or part of the world. So the idea that you can just do this cleanly without having, you know, high transparency standards and really, really good data leaves the digital service provider or the, you know, the service, you know, potentially liable for infringement if they don't know what they can't play. And on the songwriter side means that, you know, well, maybe they know they have to pay the top, you know, 10% of writers, but everybody else, it starts to become an open question.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to get into. So let's kind of talk about transparency. And, you know, I think this is a big issue right now because of the launch of Apple Music and then all of the resultant confusion where, you know, just today I saw a letter from Beggar's Banquet about, you know, hey, we don't know what's happening. We might have to hold out. There's, you know, they're telling us that now Apple Connect is going to be royalty free and they're not going to pay us for the first 3 months of the free trial and all this. And I mean, this all seems insane and kind of weirdly, like, I don't understand. I mean, I understand why they're letting it play out in public, but I'm also just sort of disgusted by it. But I mean, again, like, do you think this is another example of why we need more transparency in any of this? Because this all seems to have come to light in a really bizarre way.
Sure. I mean, these are also the kind of conditions that you end up with in a purely direct licensing universe. I'm not like some sort of like Maoist, you know, like central planning socialist hippie. Like, I just want to make sure that the artists are being able to be, you know, cut into the value that's generated from their work and that they understand the terms under which that work is licensed or assigned. And, you know, this is a kind of a problem of you know, maybe the major labels making, you know, potentially the services, but, you know, they enter into these agreements and they're all under non-disclosure terms. So you can't, you know, if you're an outsider, you have no way of, if you're not party to those agreements, you have no way of knowing what's in them. They've got most favored nation clauses, which means the big folks get served first. And if anybody else gets a better deal, they automatically get the same deal. And then, you know, outside of the transparency issue, there's the issue of leverage, who has it and under what conditions. And, you know, I think the independent label sector is doing some things right by calling attention to, you know, these inequities, because, you know, they are a growing and percentage of market share globally for music, and they do have really, really you know, like in demand acts. But it's not just, I mean, you could probably say that about unaffiliated artists as well, or artists, there are some artists whose you know, rights need to be respected in whatever environment we're talking about. You know, the trick is probably to make sure that we have structures that properly account for the payment, the royalty collection and distribution, that that money is being paid expediently, that that money is being paid accurately, that money is being paid equitably at a global scale. Do we have the pipes, so to speak, or the back-end infrastructure, the data infrastructure to accomplish that? And then the other side of it is really like, you know, do we have to really take a closer look at, you know, who is benefiting the most from the use of music in a digital environment? The way things are trending right now, I think the only, like, service providers that in the not too far off future that will be able to afford to do this will be like companies that have other paths to profit. So it's kind of like, I call them the four horsemen. It'll be like Apple, Google, Amazon, and Facebook if they decide to play. And so that, you know, you got to ask yourself, like, is that an improvement over the old music industry and ecosystem? And then, of course, if you're on the creator side, you're usually like the last one to know. It's hard to have any sight lines into what these deal terms are, even if you're signed to a label. So we're getting like to a point where instead of having a more functional global digital music marketplace that that functions efficiently and pays creators accurately and expediently, we're going into a new universe of like black boxes, potential litigation, and dysfunction in terms of fracturing of the marketplace. And that's just not only bad for musicians and songwriters, that's also bad for fans, because we know what the alternative to a non-functional or non-legitimate digital marketplace looks like, because we've endured it for like the last 15 years.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that, you know, Tidal sort of, when they did their launch, they were like launched with this idea of like, we're artist friendly. And I mean, that's debatable. And now Apple has sort of said the same thing. And I mean, how, you know, looking at all that has happened since the launch of Apple Music or the release of Apple Music, which was like a week ago, you know, are they keeping their promises at all? I mean, do we really think Apple Music is going to be artist friendly? I mean, what's your take on it?
You know, Apple, sometimes people forget that Apple as a company is bigger than ExxonMobil. I think they are officially the biggest corporation on the planet of Earth. So, you know, I would have some reluctance to put all of my faith in one giant corporation, right? There is definitely the fact that Apple figured out how to make a legitimate download marketplace work and satisfy fans and pay, you know, rights holders first, and they did it very well. They weren't there first. I mean, you know, Apple is actually pretty good at laying in wait until somebody else develops a marketplace and then diving in and getting its cleats, you know, right up to the line on antitrust and so on and so forth. But, you know, there's a lot of like independent labels and artists who've look at Apple with some fondness because the iTunes store kept the lights on during some, you know, very, very difficult and bumpy years as we transitioned to digital. But, you know, to think that Apple is going to just continue that largesse is probably misplaced faith, in my opinion. First of all, you know, just from a business perspective, there's something called the Kronos effect, and that kind of sounds like MBA jargon, but basically it's like, you know, the Greek, you know, mythological figure Kronos devoured his offspring. And so the idea is like a company at a certain point has to make the decision whether it cannibalizes its sustaining innovation, its formerly sustaining innovation. And you can see where, you know, history is kind of like peppered with examples of companies that failed to do that. You know, one that comes to mind immediately would be like Kodak. They didn't make the transition to digital, and they kind of just got erased from the map with regard to image capture. But they could have. To some extent, Microsoft, even though they are still out there, you know, didn't really see the cloud coming. And so they ceded a lot of ground to collaborative software and Google. And it weakened the, you know, importance of a sustaining package that they had called the Office Suite. You know, it's more complicated than that for them. But you can see it time and time again. And so Apple, I think, at a time of their choosing, will shut down the iTunes store. So no matter what, you know, they're making a bid for, you know, this is a moon race to get streaming music to work at scale. On the on-demand side, Pandora already has achieved scale on the sort of lean-back radio side. But on the, you know, on-demand side where you choose the songs and blah, 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 it's basically kind of like who's going to get there first. And it looks like Apple, who has obviously gobs of cash to throw at this, does not need music to turn a profit, but might need music to you know, continue to make their ecosystem attractive and also, you know, a positive brand affinity. They have to find that balance between satisfying the rights holders and you know, just conquering. And right now it looks like they're putting a lot of emphasis on the conquering part. If I were like an independent label or whatever, I would be very, very nervous that, you know, if the iTunes store goes away, we are left with not just a streaming music model, but a streaming music model that is fundamentally not different from Spotify, RDO, Rhapsody, or any of the other ones in terms of how the royalties are calculated. I mean, there is the Spotify free tier, for example, but you know, unless you're an artist of considerable magnitude, you know, that's probably not going to make that much of a difference in terms of the micro pennies that you get on your royalty statement. So until you change, fundamentally change, like, oh, I don't know, how you calculate and apportion those royalties, whether it's by an all-in royalty pool, by listener hours, or by subscriber share, or whatever, then you're basically looking at the same outcome. And you know, I think what the indies might be asking themselves right now is that the future that we want? Of course, you know, the majors seem like they're hedging their bets because they have ownership stakes in Spotify up to, I've heard, anywhere between 14 and 20%. So if that company were to somehow have its initial public offering on Wall Street at an $8 billion valuation, those guys are going to get paid a lot of money. And then much like, you know, Goodfellas or like any mafia movie, if you don't have a business model, F you, that's your problem. And, you know, the main investors are like Goldman, and those guys have no problem selling something for scraps after their folks get paid out. So the question is, what are you left with? Apple, Google, Amazon, Facebook, and, you know, who has the leverage in that universe? Like, my worry was always that, you know, everybody can run screaming back into the arms of Apple, but Apple still has all the leverage. Like, they could give you contract terms that are non-negotiable and basically say, hey, if you want to be in the iTunes store, you have to sign up for our streaming service. I don't know that they did that because I haven't seen the contract. Or they could do something like, hey, if you want to participate at all in any of this, you have to accept our, you know, 3-month no royalty window. Or, hey, we're also not going to pay you for any, you know, stuff that happens over on the Connect side. You know, it's like, nobody's giving me the Apple contract, so I don't really know where the outrage meter is. And how much of it is really just kind of like counter leverage to cause a, you know, like some fuss in public to get better terms while you have the opportunity. But I do have some inherent questions about the health of a music ecosystem when there's only, you know, 3 companies that own the majority of the copyrights and 4 companies that can afford to actually bring a service to the marketplace.
Well, and I feel like the other 2 companies we're not talking about are, well, kind of talking about with Google, but you know, I had a really illuminating conversation last night with a friend of mine who works in music marketing. Like, you know, this is someone who's in essentially the industry. Right. And we were out last night and I mentioned something about Spotify's new running program because we're both runners. And I was like, oh, hey, have you tested the Spotify running thing? What do you think of it? And she's like, oh, I don't have Spotify. I was like, oh, what do you have? Like RDO or, mm-hmm. you know, Tidal? Or, mm-hmm. She's like, oh, mm-hmm. I don't have any of those. I was confused, and I was like, well, what do you do? She's like, oh, I just look stuff up on YouTube and on SoundCloud. And, you know, she does work in music marketing, so she gets a lot of stuff sent to her. But, you know, I was also sort of shocked that someone in her position wouldn't have at least one streaming service. And then I was doing some writing last week after Apple's announcement, and I called a bunch of people I knew who were just general music fans who aren't in the biz, they're not in technology, they're just regular workaday people who like music, and none of them have Spotify or any streaming service right now. And I asked them about Apple, and they were like, oh, that looks kind of cool, but meh, probably not.
Yeah.
Because, again, like, YouTube and SoundCloud, and those are free.
And I think, you know, obviously the elephant in the room would be YouTube because they have, you know, man, they exist under a different part of the law, technically, in you know, in the sense that the courts have allowed them latitude based on an interpretation of a part of federal law that gives them what's called safe harbors. Mm-hmm. So, meaning, as long as they respond to notice and takedown requests from the rights holders, and have repeat infringer policies, you know, to terminate accounts, then, you know, they are not going to be liable for statutory damages for stuff that their users put on the service. And, you know, on some level, that's like, you know, actually kind of positive. Like, those safe harbors are what, you know, gave the world Twitter and like pretty much any service that a musician uses every day, because those services wouldn't have been able to get off the ground if they had to lawyer up and, you know, seek, you know, and find, you know, workarounds for third party liability. to use a boring legal term. But the other the thing that folks couldn't anticipate at the time when these laws were drafted in the mid-1990s is the scale, of these environments. Like, if you're a small label, like maybe big enough to get pirated, like a Alligator Records or something like that, the blues label, but you know, you're not big enough to be able to automate the process like the MPAA or the IRIAA and just send notice and takedowns to, you know, the across the internet 24 hours a day, you know, because you'd maybe be better spending your money on marketing your releases, then that kind of puts you in a bit of a bind. On one level, you're a small to medium-sized enterprise, just like, you know, the small to medium-sized enterprise on the developer side. And so to me, there's some alignment of incentives there, because usually it's the smaller players in music that understand how to use an innovation before the major labels or other people figure it out, or at least that's been the case. Like, musicians figured out how to use, you know, Twitter to their advantage, for example, while other people were still being like, why would I want to tell somebody that what I had for lunch in 20 characters? But you know, YouTube has kind of found a solution sort of to this problem by coming up with basically a proprietary software and database system called Content ID, where, you know, the rights holder can choose to block that at upload. Like, if a user tries to upload it and Content ID sniffs it out, it can say nope. It also can give the rights holder the opportunity to monetize through advertising and also select demographic data about the use, which might be valuable.
The issue with Content ID, though, from what I've heard, is it's pretty easy to cheat. So when the Rihanna song premiered on Tidal, it was on YouTube within 5 minutes. And so I listened to some of the tracks, and they were either slightly sped up or slightly slowed down or something little bit changed. You know, not enough so that you would notice it. It wasn't like they remixed the track, but they just made the little, you know, it's very easy to make a little tweak and then put it up there. And, you know, eventually that stuff all gets pulled down. But at that point, everyone's already heard it. It kind of doesn't really matter. And then it just makes sense for them to say, oh, heck, here's the official version. Go for it.
Yeah, it's definitely not bulletproof. And, you know, the other thing is that, you know, the information management is still proprietary. So as we're trying to figure out other things that I think would be, you know, equally important, if not more important, like, what if we had, you know, interoperable information registries about copyright ownership and who should get paid that were machine readable and global? Then we could get all of these micro cash registers ringing at a global scale, and we'd get more money in the system, and hopefully more of it would flow back to creators. There'd be less black boxes. That's a huge fundamental challenge that I don't think gets solved even by having, you know, one company control the data sets. Which is basically what Content ID is. It's like, participate in our system, which, you know, does have some advantages. It's probably better than nothing. On the other hand, when you've got that many eyeballs and you can achieve some kind of scale, that money does add up. And also, there are probably other peripheral benefits that accrue from having that kind of visibility. But it's just, in this marketplace, it is just so... It has become atomic, randomized, and very, very difficult to predict. And the problem is, like, people are used to a predictable industry, even if they were gaming the systems and it wasn't really particularly fair to creators. At least they knew, you know, the terms of distribution. They understood the terms of retail. They understood the terms of retail returns. They understood how much cocaine you had to give the radio guy. You know what I mean? It was a predictable business. And now it's anything but. So what I encourage people to consider is, like, yeah, sure, there's probably a lot to be done to optimize copyright law to reflect the new digital realities. But going beyond that, we just need better systems for information management so we can have more trust in how music is used and monetized in this environment that we have, to say nothing of the next disruptive innovation that's going to come tomorrow. Until we get to that part, until we have the transparency and the pipes, the back-end pipes, then we're going to basically be chasing our tails.
So let's talk about some of the folks that are proposing solutions. Like Cobalt obviously got a lot of attention with that Wired piece. There's another company called Revelator that's smaller. It's a little bit more of a startup. I think it's geared towards, smaller acts and smaller labels. You know, they both are promising transparency. They're promising a lot of data. They're promising real solutions. I mean, do you think either of these products or both of these products can potentially deliver?
I think that there should be a commercial incentive here because, profit is a motivator. And, for a company like Cobalt, differentiating factor. They're the world's fourth largest music publisher, by the way, but they've chosen a different system. They've chosen, like, for example, instead of me as a songwriter transferring my rights to Cobalt for no less than 35 years, they are not going to take a permanent assignment of my rights from me. They're going to manage my rights for me and take a percentage of what my rights generate in this global marketplace. So I think that is a shift in a way of doing business and that I generically support and I think FMC is interested in. The other part of it is, I don't know if any of these companies are going to succeed, but the idea that they're trying to develop business here will hopefully encourage the rest of the industry to become more transparent and understand that having your house in order with regard to data is the new standard, right? So either way, they hopefully drag more people kicking and screaming towards a more workable future.
So also, how much of this is a historical problem? Because, we start looking back and it's funny now in retrospect, but SoundScan didn't really exist until 1991. And before that, charts were self-reported essentially. So the amount of fraud that must have gone on, I'm sure there's some epic stories, but there was no data out there. So now you look at a lot of labels and they can probably credibly say, yeah, we'd love to have better data on this. We have 30 years of recorded music to go back through and tag. And, for some of the big stuff, they'll probably take care of it. If it's an album that sold 50 copies that they put out in 1974, is it really worth it at that point?
That's the problem. There's no incentive for them to do it. In some cases, they may be able to credibly claim that they don't know what they own because there's been so many mergers and acquisitions, getting down to, three remaining major labels that there may very well be some confusion in terms of the ownership chain. I don't know if that's a super valid excuse. The other part of it is their worth is basically that, not just the superstars, but also that back catalog that can be leveraged in negotiation with digital service providers and stuff. So it's not so much, they still don't have the incentive to be clear about what they own. It's just if you want our catalog, you have to agree to our terms. That doesn't really do all that much. I'm not so worried about services. I'm more worried about artists. If you were going to try to get your copyright back from a label after 35 years, first of all, they'd argue whether you even have that right, which is BS. And second of all, the second thing they might say is prove that we're the owner, And without a really killer entertainment lawyer, which costs a lot of money, you might not be in a position to ever receive any benefit from this thing or even, recapture it for other reasons. But look, the real problem here is the fact that this industry has been trained to be opaque for one reason or another. That might have been okay when there was gallons of cash just sloshing around in the system and everybody could take their bit. It's not so okay now when actually what our fundamental problem is preventing further contraction. I would say that the next challenge would be, what would it look like if we could have actual growth in the music industry? Wouldn't that be wouldn't that blow people's minds? Because, people are like, oh, music is competing against Mindshare. There's cat videos, there's video games, there's Game of Thrones, there's blah, 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 there's Oculus Rift. But, music is a layer of everything. So I think that we actually could get back to a growth trajectory if we as an industry decided that there's a common incentive in being more transparent and forthcoming with our data and information systems. I don't know if it'll solve every single problem under the sun, but it's certainly, it would do a lot to increase the trust capital, which is definitely running at a deficit. And it would, I think it would probably lubricate this new marketplace, because then you could actually kind of have the pistons firing on mixing metaphors left and right. But you know what I mean? You could get those micro penny cash registers jingling at a global scale, and then we'll see where we end up. I mean, maybe it's still like, you know, not perfect, but, you know, we can make those adjustments. I just know that to be 15 years into this digital reality and not having these things sorted out is certainly not doing anybody any great shakes, especially artists.
Well, yeah, and let's talk about the global scale for a minute, because, I mean, A, that is potential for growth, right? All these new markets have come online. There's, like, emerging middle classes and all these new countries. But, you know, then you're talking about, like, I've been reading a lot about and researching Nigeria, because Nigeria and Lagos in particular has this like incredible music scene. It's really vibrant, and there's so many artists, and it's great. Like, their bookkeeping makes the record labels in the 70s look like an accounting firm. Like,
and some of those countries might have had copyright, you know, for like 5 hot minutes, if at all.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not just true of the African continent nations, but, you know, actually former Soviet satellite states are kind of just starting to figure this out too. And usually they're kind of, you know, there's basically like one official who's in charge of intellectual property for, you know, everything from books to plays to music to, you know, audio visual. And, you know, so it is definitely a challenge, and you can't just solve it overnight. But if you start actually making, you know, these things, you know, sort of baking these things into the cake, so to speak, then you get more people incentivized to actually participate in these systems that will bring more benefit to more people. You know, if I have a hit song in Nigeria, whatever that looks like, and there's a way for me to have those, you know, whether it's subscription fee, micro pennies, or download, or patronage, or whatever the system is, like, I want to be able to feel like that money is being properly tracked and the money's getting back to me. So it's not going to happen overnight, but if we can't figure it out in the world's largest music market or the Eurozone, then we're not going to figure it out. And then we're just going to end up, you know, basically sniping at each other, you know, from our various, you know, little sectors. It's like the last season of The Sopranos, where the guys just keep whacking each other over an increasingly small piece of turf. Man, I'm using a lot of mafia references.
Yeah, but, I'm a little scared right now.
But you know what I mean. It's like, here's something that's really funny. I was talking to a person who has a lot of experience in Wall Street, particularly around when those folks were trying to put together the sort of the automated, computerized derivatives marketplace that, yeah, sure, pretty much came close to tanking the global economy like back in 2008. But I use this as an example only because if you want to talk about people who are very, very proprietary about their data and have the biggest egos on the planet, if you can get those guys to pull their informational resources because they see that there's more money to be made, then I don't see any reason why you couldn't get the big heads of the music industry to move towards a more greater data integrity, interoperability, and transparency. Yeah. But what is it going to take? I don't know. I hope it doesn't take another, like, however many, you know, millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, reduction in global revenue from recorded music. Because that's not good for artists either.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're at a point where, you know, the other thing is, I feel like people like you and I move faster than a lot of other people. And I don't know that that's, like, a compliment necessarily, or that means we're superhuman. But I think what it really means is that, you know, we see things further down the road, and then we forget that there's all these people out there who still are sort of playing catch up. So,
well, I move fast just because people are like shooting arrows at me and stuff all the time. I'm just kidding. but you know, you're right. And a lot of it too is that there's really good people that really do love music and like working around music. And, you know, they have jobs in the remaining jobs, you know, in systems that, you know, they don't want to be further displaced. I totally get it, right? Like, and you know, that was one of the things where that frustrated the sort of the governmental push in Europe anyway towards global registry databases is that, you know, it all sounds like a good idea until you realize that it might actually displace your entire reason for existing. Like yeah. If you're a performing rights society or whatever, or, and so even with the government nudge, it was, you know, it's been very, very difficult to get anyone to actually, you know, come forward with this thing. There's operational costs, there's participatory allowances, there are, you know, local, there's language barriers, you know. So, like, basically you have to, like, to me, think of this as, like, we should start with, you know, we should get out of just the alpha part of alphanumeric and have, like, unique, globally recognized numeric signifiers for both the sound recording and the musical work. Have those be standardized and sort of operated by somebody. And then you can just start building the systems. You know, it doesn't have to all just be all one, you know, one ring to rule them all kind of system. People can actually start working with that baseline of data and starting to construct stuff in the marketplace because there might be profit in it. And I think once you get to the profit motive, maybe you're getting closer to a functional industry. But first you have to get people over that fear of being further displaced. Because, I mean, God, how many jobs were shed in the traditional music industries over the last 15 years? An awful lot.
Yeah.
You know, were all of them like, you know, like necessary, like perfectly necessary. Like, I don't know. But, you know, at the same time, it's, you know, you can understand people's resistance to, you know, run screaming into a future that A, they might not fully understand, and B, may represent a threat to, you know, the job that they're trying to hang on to.
Yeah. And I feel like that's a big part of it is if you look at who's running these labels, you know, like they've come up in the age of, like, we've got private jets and we've got this and that and we're in our helicopters to the Hamptons and, you know, the CEO of Warner is leaving to run a private helicopter company. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, that's who we're dealing with, and we're dealing with people that are going to hang on by the skin of their teeth because they don't want to give up their private jet. And
yeah, it's true. I mean, there may be a generational shift coming. I think that generational shift will probably put a lot of the – you know, potentially put a lot of the leverage in the hands of music managers. And I think that music managers are almost trying to prepare themselves for that eventuality. And, you know, those folks actually, you know, it shouldn't be an every person for themselves thing. We need, like I said, reliable third party agencies, bodies, whatever the hell they are, for profit or nonprofit, to help assist with the management of data and the collection and distribution of royalties. So whether that's a private company like the ones that we just talked about, or whether that's like a new form of PRO that is just more, you know, better at its job, so to speak, in managing the digital information flow, it has to happen. But, you know, the new power brokers in, you know, in a post-label universe, once, you know, it's hard to say that these guys are ever going to go away because they've aggregated the most copyrights. Like, they consolidated on purpose. They consolidated as a way to hedge their bets against, you know, the future. Because as long as the copyright laws are the way they are, you know, and you have to go through them to obtain, you know, these large swaths of catalog, including back catalog, then, you know, they're going to be able to self-perpetuate and not be divested by their international, you know, corporate parent companies. But I can almost imagine a future where, like, a really good artist, you know, team that, like, replicates many of the traditional functions of a label, that's nimble enough to cut deals with the DSPs based on their demand, you know, might, and has, like, really great partners to manage the cash registers and the data processes, might actually be more empowered than, you know, those same people were 25 years ago. It's like one of those things. You look into the eight ball and it's like, future cloudy, ask again later, or, you know, uncertain, ask again later. But I can almost imagine it, you know what I mean? To me, like, it doesn't matter whether they're, you know, the traditional label structure remains, goes away, or something new and similar comes to replace it with some of the same competencies. What matters to me is, do we have reliable systems that artists can trust? Yeah. Do we have deal terms that artists understand? And do those terms return any of the value in an equitable way back to the people who are powering this ecosystem with their expression? You know, if I knew the answers to that, I could just retire. But I think but starting at what you want, the future that you want, is probably the smart thing. And at Future Music Coalition, that's pretty much what we want. And a pony. We want that and yes. a pony.
Don't we all want ponies? Well, I think that's probably a pretty good place to wrap it up. So
awesome.
If people want to find you on the internet, where can they find you?
Futureofmusic.org. We are constantly reporting out on stuff, you know, in the marketplace, in the public policy, in the courts, and really we're kind of like an educational research and a translation engine. So busy musicians and their teams can understand what some of this stuff means and make their own decisions, you know, based on that information. We also have a subsite called the Artist Revenue Streams Project, which can be found at money.futureofmusic.org, which represents our latest research project into artist revenue streams. And you can find out a lot of information about what revenue streams are available to musicians and composers in this brave new world, as well as how these revenue streams have changed over time. And so that's a project that we're going to continue and I think might be very interesting for your listeners. And lastly, we have the Future of Music Policy Summit. Believe it or not, we've had 15 of these. Our 15th Future Music Policy Summit takes place at Georgetown University on October 26 and 27 of 2015. And you can find information about that at summit.futureofmusic.org. And we would love to see any and all of your listeners in D.C. for that, because that's where really all the kind of, you know, movers and shakers and futurists and, you know, big thinkers come to debate the stuff that we've been talking about today, Courtney.
Cool. Well, we'd love to be part of that. Well, thank you again so much for taking the time to chat with us.
You got it. Talk to you soon.
That's all for this episode of the Music Business Podcast. Thank you to Hypebot for helping us put this podcast out. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, please send me an email at kyle.bylin@gmail.com. That's kyle.bylin@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion.